adopt the rules.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of Senate Model Committee rules.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded by Senator Minnis that we adopt the rules. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay, the rules have been adopted. Okay, this is a new committee, Health Policy Committee. We have also the Health Resources Committee, which Senator Fisher will chair and I will co-chair. And we will somehow separate the bills to the appropriate committee. We're not quite sure that will always happen, and we're not even quite sure how it will happen. But we will work very closely together. So at this time, I would like us to just introduce ourselves and tell a little bit about why we, what we expect to get out of this committee, what we expect to happen. So I'll start with on my left.
Hi. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, second committee I served in with a Democrat chair since 1989, so my other committee is with Tony Corcoran chairing, so it's a bit of a paradigm shift for some Republicans.
Get used to it.
Get used to it, yeah. But, you know, I want to say that the Health Policy Committee was really an idea that was born out of a conference that I went to, and I think Senator Morissette, you were there too, that the National Conference of State Legislatures sponsored, in which there were tons of presentations on issues relevant to health care, health policy in the states, and health care trends that are occurring, which I recognize, having served in this body for, this is my ninth session, that most legislators and the legislatures around the country have little understanding or little knowledge of the dynamics of health care and what's going on even within our own communities regarding this issue. So as we get into the legislative sessions, we've got one faction of individuals that represent one group and another that represents something else, and so on and so forth, and everybody has a piece of legislation they have a proprietary interest in, and we say yes to some and no to others, and so we have, by and large, a hodgepodge of laws relevant to health care, and most of us who serve in this body have a very restrained and constricted view of health care, generally derived from our own personal experiences, et cetera. So this committee, as I suggested to the leadership of the Senate where we've been negotiating on Senate structure and rules, would hopefully be a committee that looks at the future of health care. So the differences in vision between the Human Resources Committee that Senator Fisher chairs and this committee would be that we're going to hopefully look at the future of health care in Oregon and nationally and various trends that we're seeing, and then whether or not there is legislation that is necessary, and we're also going to be serving as a policy committee that's going to get a lot of the other bills and just some bleed over from Human Resources. But hopefully to enhance and look down the road to see where health policy needs to go. An example of this on a national statistic where there were 5,000 dentists that retired from practice last year in the United States and only 2,000 graduating from dental school. And that trend apparently has occurred for a number of years. There's clearly a deficit in individuals going into dentistry. That creates a problem for the states and for health care. Oregon has, like many other states, the problems of rural health care versus urban health care, and how do you get service delivery in those areas? We know we have a nursing shortage, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, the idea, and the leadership was very, very good to me in informing this committee and allowing me some freedom to help generate this idea, and Senator Morissette has given me some latitude to kind of express my views here, and the ultimate decisions are up to him as the chair with respect to where the committee goes. But my hope is that legislators and the legislature will have a larger, deeper, more broad understanding of health care, health policy, and hopefully try to resolve some very complex issues. And with that, thank you.
Senator Walker, do you have some hope and aspirations?
Well, thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. Actually, if anyone's done any polling, which I know everyone on this committee probably has at some point or another when they're running for election, the number one issue for most people in Oregon is education. The number two issue is health care. So I think it's really incumbent upon us as legislators to try to look to the future and see where we are going with health care. It's the rising, probably the number one rising cost of doing business in Oregon, and it is a serious, serious problem. So that is my aspiration for this committee, that we can come up with some great ideas to make sure that Oregonians get some of those basic needs met and then some. And I hope to work with all of you towards that effort.
I would like to identify where you're from, if you didn't, which district and which area.
I'm from Senate District 25, formerly Senate District 11. It's the cities of Gresham, Wood Village, Trout Hill, Fairview, and a small portion that's unincorporated in Multnomah County.
And I am Senate District 7, which comprises of the cities of Eugene and Junction City. And I've just come over from the House, where I've served 4 years, where I used to have part of Springfield, but no longer.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been several years since I served on Human Resources, and this new committee is really intriguing to me. I will be on Human Resources as well as the Health Policy. Been involved in a variety of ways, particularly interested in how we grow the cost of our health care when most health care procedures are now costing less. And so I'm one who believes that there are ways that we can control costs better than we're doing with third-party payer system. And that is one of the main interests that I have. I think that it's time to look again at medical savings accounts. Figures I received last year was that 71% of our population spends less than $500 a year on health care. Another 24% spend less than $2,000 a year on health care. And that remaining 5% is costing huge amounts of money from 2000 upwards. And so I'm been involved 21 years caregiver for my parents who broke their backs in an automobile accident when they were 58 and 61 years old. I really appreciate the opportunity to serve on this committee. Looking forward to it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am representing a whole new area. Having served Western Washington County for 10 years, I now serve parts of four counties. I have picked up Newburgh, Sherwood, Wilsonville, St. Paul, and Kaiser. So District 13.
Thank you. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm the senator now from Senate District 24 after all the gerrymandering was done. I had better boundaries than before, actually. I represent everything from Interstate 205 east to the Gresham city line, where Senator Minnis picks up in Multnomah County and down in a little bit into Clackamas County now for the first time. The easy way I have of telling people where my district is to say, have you been to the airport? Well, you just flew over my district. I've been in the legislature 10 years and have always, I think when Larry Campbell was the Speaker of the House, he ran into this Methodist preacher and said, "Preacher, put him on human services." And I've kind of been there ever since, either in ways and means subs or on the full committee, one sort or another. I will not outline an agenda, but more of a guiding principle. And my guiding principle is that there are certain minimums for a civilized society, and that is that you take care of the weakest and the poor and the elderly. Yes, you have to be wise. Yes, you have to live within certain budget constraints, but at least begin with a guiding principle that involves compassion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher,
co-chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To show my bipartisanship, I started out in the House on the same committee with Senator Shields, and he stayed there a term longer than I did, and then followed me to the Senate. And we've been on a lot of the same committees, working on the same issues. I'm not going to reiterate all these things. This is a new committee to me, and Senator Minnis had a large part to do with starting up this committee, and I'm leaning on him to provide the direction. It was rather interesting because we had bills assigned to this committee before we actually knew what this committee outline was, so I tried to ascertain from our leadership in the Senate exactly what goals they had and what they were assigning bills over here for, and I'm not sure I got a real satisfactory answer, so there's going to be a few things that we're going to have to figure out as we go down the line, but Senator Morissette has been very courteous to me in the setting up of this committee. I intend to do the same with him and Human Resources Committee, where we switch positions, and I'm looking forward to an opportunity to do this and to show further my bipartisanship. Senator Shields and I both are living in a session in the same housing complex. So
so when I couldn't find him any other way, I left a note in his car door this weekend, right?
Right. And he did get to me the other way, too, so I got the message. But anyway, I have represented for the first two sessions that I was elected the representative district that was the only full district in Douglas County. And when I changed to the Senate, then I picked up a little bit of Josephine and Jackson County to go along with and a little more of Douglas County. And then thanks to our good Secretary of State, and I won't use the word gerrymander because the Supreme Court said there was no political influence in this for your update of your information, Senator Shields. I wound up with Curry County and the coast all the way up to Bandon, and then the inland up and around north of Coos Bay and North Bend. And I lost about 10-mile strip along the edge of the north bank of the Rogue River, but I go down almost to Grants Pass and clear over to Weimar. I lost Sutherland and Glide and areas there, and the Diamond Lake area in Douglas County. So I have a five-county area now with all of Coos, or Curry County, part of Coos, part of Douglas, part of Josephine, and part of Jackson that I represent. And I'm doing the best job I can, kind of stretched out there. There should have been two people. I was large enough that I divided in half. I could do a better job of getting over on the coast and getting back to Roseburg. But we're doing the best we can, and I'm looking forward to, again, being able to help out in an arena that is extremely personal and extremely important to so many of our Oregon citizens.
I'd like to introduce Marjorie Taylor, who is our committee administrator. Actually, she will serve as the administrator for both of our health committees. And Marjorie, would you introduce
our... Certainly, and working with us is Sarah Nell Allen. She'll be our committee support for both committees, and we're happy to serve.
Okay, thank you. I'd just like to say a couple words about what I envision as some of the things that we might cover, and we've already touched on some of them. Future of the Oregon Health Plan. I'm sure that we'll be looking at that in many different ways. Health insurance in general, the costs and the medical economics of health insurance, that is a fairly broad area. Mental health and its delivery system in the future. There's been a lot of controversy about the whole mental health program and particularly the delivery system. Preparing for natural and biological disasters, bioterrorism. On our next meeting, Dr. Grant Higginson will be here from the Public Health Department, and we will again get into that whole area. Examining the makeup and the duties of the Mental Health Advisory Board of Oregon. That is related to our mental health issue. Environmental and related problems that may arise. There are all sorts of things that would come under that. Long-distance care in the future. Now, long-term care insurance, and how do we encourage people to become insured? How do we encourage people to invest at a young age when they think they're going to live forever and nothing will ever happen to them? That's a problem. We need to address that. Patient safety, medical errors, that's a huge area. Medical malpractice issues, liability insurance for practitioners, we may touch on that. At the conference that we were at, that Senator Minnis mentioned, obesity was an interesting issue. And ironically, that hunger, which Oregon, you know, is prevalent in, well, Oregon is the number one state in hunger, at least it was reported to be. Oregon also seems to have a high level of obesity, and there seems to be a relationship between the two and the kinds of food people eat. If they don't have a lot to spend on food. So that's an interesting issue. Rural health care access, adequacy, competency, that's a huge issue. Medical staffing needs, nurses, nursing home, adult, foster care liability, and other insurance needs. I have people from adult foster care homes telling me that they can't get neither liability nor health insurance for themselves at a reasonable cost. Cost of pharmaceuticals as they relate to the medical needy, workman's compensation, and worker safety. These are just some of the areas. And again, the issues will be divided between the two committees. And if there are issues that we should be looking at, I would be happy to entertain ideas. Okay, today Jane Thorne is with us, and Lynn Reed. Okay, Lynn, did you want to wait until... Okay, I know that Jane is on a tight schedule, so Jane, do you want to tell us who you are and why you are here? Gee whiz.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jane Thorne. I'm currently the Acting Director of the Department of Human Services and awaiting Senate confirmation. I actually have a confirmation hearing later this afternoon. I didn't really realize it was a confirmation hearing. I do need to be out. I need to be back at the Human Services Building for 2 o'clock. So I know you asked me to come today to provide an update on the Oregon Health Plan, a little bit about it, where we are now and where we may go beyond that. Lynn Reed, who is the Acting Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, will be staying, though, so that if you have additional questions, I'll do the talking and I'll let Lynn answer the questions. But what I'd like to do is just to first of all do kind of a brief background. You've all been around the legislature, but sometimes it helps just to be reminded of what was it we were trying to accomplish, what have we accomplished, and where are we right now, and where might we be in the future. Having listened to the comments you all made, just a suggestion, I guess, I would offer, especially when looking at medical insurance and some of the larger issues, I know that the Office of Health Policy and Research, in fact, I just came from a meeting where they had put together an outline for a House committee that they will spend a couple days looking at national trends and Oregon trends, and I think that would probably be very helpful for this committee also to provide a context and to see what's going on nationally and in Oregon. And then also I would suggest having Rocky King at some point, who is the administrator of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, because especially FEOP is tied in with the Oregon Health Plan. And lastly, for those of you who are on Human Services, I believe I'm coming to your committee on Monday to talk about DHS generally, so maybe there will be some issues we can carry over to there. Let me just take a few minutes to kind of go back to the beginning of why we had the Oregon Health Plan and where we've been. I think back and I really began exploring the need to do something back in the late 80s. And actually, I was at the Medicaid program from 1987 to 1995. I think what became clear through some crises that occurred during that time is that it was clear that there were the poorest people in certain categories had access to coverage and probably a fairly good benefit package, if not maybe not compensated well for. But fairly good benefits regardless of the effectiveness, and that they were covered through state Medicaid programs. That those who had employer-sponsored insurance had fairly good coverage as well. That Medicare, which is a federal program, provided fairly good coverage for those who were elderly and certain disabled, regardless of their income, but that there were in Oregon at the time about 400,000 people in the middle who didn't fit any of those categories, who had nothing. And so the question was, what happens to those four, and what happened at that time, and what happens now to those who are without health care coverage? If they got sick enough or ill enough, they'd end up in a hospital emergency room, where the care at that point is a pretty expensive care, expensive to deliver, and they may have been at a place where they were more sick than they might otherwise have been. That if they could not pay for the cost of their care, then those costs were shifted to other payers. So those who did pay for care picked up the cost of uncompensated care. What did that mean? That meant that those who were paying for coverage, so employer-sponsored coverage premiums then rose, which then also caused employers to question whether or not they could continue providing coverage. So they might drop coverage, which then puts more people back into the category of uninsured, and so you have kind of a vicious cycle of cost shift. So when the Oregon Health Plan was originally conceived, the premises of the health plan were that government should have responsibility for the poor, those under the poverty level, regardless of what category they fit in, that employers should have responsibility for those who are working, and that public dollars for benefits should be focused on those things that did the greatest good overall. So we had hoped through the health plan to reduce the percentage of Oregonians without health coverage, to contain the rate of growth of health care expenditures, and to reduce or eliminate cost shifting, but to promote accountability for explicit priorities, having trade-offs of what are we going to cover and who are we going to cover. But the original components of the Medicaid portion of the health plan was that, or actually there were a number of components of the health plan itself. We had Medicaid reform to cover all those under poverty, an employer mandate. We had then a number of incentives for employers, small market insurance reform to encourage employers to provide the coverage on their own. And lastly, the Oregon Medical Insurance Program pool, which was a high-risk pool for those who are uninsurable, where they can purchase coverage, but costs are also subsidized through assessments on it, on insurers. As far as the Medicaid piece of it, it was fairly simple when you think about the policy. It was to cover all of those under the federal poverty level with coverage, regardless of whether they fit into a category of being elderly, disabled, in a family with dependent children. That we were saying, if you're on the federal poverty level, government, again, would have a responsibility for your health care coverage. That the benefits would be based on cost effectiveness through a prioritized list of health care services. So rather than just using the regular Medicaid categories of what's mandatory and what's optional, to really look closely at what treatments for what conditions were most effective, and to make some decisions about benefits based on that. And that then we would cover the reasonable cost of providing those services in a managed care environment. We wanted to promote managed care as a way to contain costs, and that the reimbursement under managed care or paid to a managed care plan should be sufficient enough to cover reasonable costs. So all of this, though, required waivers, and we were kind of the first state out of the box, and we spent 2 years. We were turned down by the Bush administration and eventually approved by the Clinton administration in 1993 to begin this. And since then, waivers are prevalent. We kind of say in Oregon, waivers are us, but we were the first ones out of the chute with a comprehensive really restructuring of the Medicaid program on a statewide basis. What became known as the Oregon Health Plan then was implemented beginning in February 1994. And so what's happened since then? First of all, the employer mandate never happened, and so the focus really has been on the public sector program. Again, remembering the Oregon Health Plan as originally conceived was much broader than Medicaid reform. But we have done quite a bit within the public program. We've served more than 1.4 million people in the last 9 years in the Oregon Health Plan, so it has touched on the lives of many Oregonians. I think today when you look at the Oregon Health Plan, which is a combination of kind of traditional Medicaid and an expansion of that program, in many communities, 20% of those in the community in any given month are receiving services under the Oregon Health Plan. If you look at the report that has been passed out, and this still is a draft report that will be provided in final form at a later time from the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research, I think if you look at page 2, let me put on my glasses so I can see what's on page 2. I think you'll see that some of the things we've been able to accomplish. Hospital charity care has declined more than 53% since the inception of the Medicaid reform under the health plan. And so we do have the amount of money that's had to be shifted to other payers. Certainly the percentage and the amount has decreased. I think if you look at tables 1 and 2 on those pages, you can see that, again, the health plan began in 1994, and you can see for both all Oregonians, which is table 1, and then for children, table 2, significant decreases in the percentage of people and children, not that children aren't people, but overall and children, significant decreases in the percentage of uninsured in the state. But you'll also see that what's happened over the last couple of years is that those numbers or those percentages creeping back up. And I do, as I understand it, the 2002 data will be released within the next few days, and it's continuing an upward trend in the percentage of uninsured. So I think that, you know, we certainly made a lot of strides in the mid-90s, but over the last few years, last 2 to 4 years, we're seeing that kind of our trends are not going in the direction we'd like. Let me touch briefly on what we have done within the Medicaid program since the inception of the health plan to try to control costs. And I think you'll, as you deal with looking at private sector coverage, we all know costs of health care are going up astronomically. This is not just a phenomenon of the Oregon health plan. But we have done a number of things over the years to try to control costs within the Medicaid program, within the Oregon Health Plan. We have moved the line on the benefit package on the prioritized list for a total of 36 lines. We've had three sets of movements that have been approved. The most recent was approved by the federal government and became effective at the beginning of this month, an 8-line movement. And I think that we are seeing at least the current administration is indicating a willingness to be more flexible on moving the line than maybe the previous administration was. We instituted premiums for people in 1996 who were not other, for those who were what we would call the expansion population, those who were not otherwise eligible for Medicaid, people under the federal poverty level who didn't fit into a category. So we did institute premiums in 1996. We began the program with a no assets test, basically saying people should not have to completely clean out their bank account in order to pay for one health care bill, that we wanted to try to encourage people to get in early to get some of the primary preventive care. Over the years, we've moved from no assets test to a $5,000 assets test to now a $2,000 assets test. So if a person has more than $2,000 in liquid assets, or the family does, they would no longer qualify. We've put in more stringent eligibility reviews. When we started, this was a fairly simple process, and it was a simple process by design, and we wanted to focus on not putting up horrendous barriers to care, and we wanted to not have to spend a lot of money on administration of having people send in all sorts of documentation about their assets or various status. But over the time, we have implemented more stringent eligibility reviews. That has meant we've had to increase some of our administrative costs in doing that. The 2001 legislature also passed a number of actions, some of which are just beginning to take effect right now. So what are called voluntary copays on prescriptions and ambulatory services, reduced pharmacy reimbursement, implementing preferred drug list. So those are all actions occurring during this biennium to try to deal with some of the costs of the health plan. I'd like to move now into kind of our OHP2 waivers, why we went about going after some new waivers, what the waivers have allowed us to do, and where we are now in implementation of those waivers, and what's coming ahead between the various the budget reductions we're looking at. I think that what we found was that costs, as I mentioned, of health of the Oregon Health Plan had been continuing to escalate over the years, as it has with health care generally. But the main mechanism we had really counted on is our ability to control costs in the health plan, and that meant moving the line on the prioritized list of health care services. Really had not been a mechanism that we were being given much opportunity by the federal government to use. Although the Clinton administration did approve our waivers, I would say they never really accepted the premise of using the prioritized list to use it as a cost control mechanism. And so I remember back in the late 90s, when I was on a phone, just seems like that, when I was on a phone call, I'd actually moved to the governor's office, was working at that time on some federal issues. I remember we had a request in to move the line, and we had, I don't know how many phone calls with the federal government on no longer wanting to cover treatment for diaper rash. And it, from their perspective, that was very controversial because we had a program which our benefit package applied to everyone, whether they were people traditionally eligible for Medicaid and for whom the federal government felt a responsibility, statutory responsibility, versus those who only had coverage because of our waivers to cover these people. So they were very concerned about no longer providing certain benefits to those, especially those who would meet categorical eligibility. And so I think it was clear, or the questions that we were asking, can we sustain the growth in this program given very little ability to control costs, given the revenue situation that we were seeing come down the road? This was during the 2001 session. At the same time, looking back at the statistics on the percentage of the uninsured, we were seeing the percentage and the number of uninsured in this state growing. And certainly the concerns about, for those who are $1 over the poverty level, what about them? And so we were coming back to having over 400,000 people without health care insurance. And so looking to see, is there something we could do through these waivers that would allow us to both better contain costs in the current program and begin to address some of the concerns about the uninsured. This chart here, the Three Towers chart, this is probably the easiest way for me to explain conceptually what we were doing in our OHP2 waivers. And the left side is a percentage of poverty. It's not number of people. But what we did, if you look at just the left two, or the left and the middle column, if you put these two together now, where the white places are, this is the Oregon Health Plan, who's eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. What we did and the legislature did through House Bill 2519 in 2001 was to say, let's look at the people on the left are those who would be categorically eligible for Medicaid. These are the ones who the federal government would say you are entitled to Medicaid, and where they had the most concerns about reductions or significant reductions in benefits. The group in the middle, who we called new eligible, were those who were adults who did not fit into any certain category. They weren't disabled, they weren't pregnant, they weren't elderly. So they were the people under the federal poverty level who we had brought in under our original waivers. And we said, let's take a look at having a different benefit package for these people, one that looks more like a commercial benefit package. At the same time, we wanted to try to get some federal match on the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And the FEOP program has been funded totally by state funds. I think currently it's tobacco settlement dollars. No federal funds. And I think there's certainly a belief that if we could grow that program with some federal funds, utilize the private sector, especially employer-sponsored insurance, that we could make some significant inroads into increasing the number of people with insurance coverage. And so the concept here was to really have kind of three, the OHP Plus and OHP Standard is what we were calling in the middle, which is a reduced and a benefit package that looks more like a commercial population, and to gain federal match on the FEOP program. and that by doing that, we would, with that, and we would also expand coverage on the left to pregnant women and kids under 19 from 170% of poverty to 185%. That by doing that, we would be able to expand, be able to have the ability to cap enrollment in these expansion programs, so that we would do it without any additional cost to the state. So we would reduce benefits, we would take the savings from that and additional federal match, and we would use that, plow that back in to expand coverage. So there would be no additional cost to the state. We were able to gain approval in October 15th of our waivers, and they, having negotiated the original waivers and having been part of the negotiations on these waivers, I would just say it was kind of night and day in terms of the flexibility. Federal government was willing to allow us considerable flexibility in terms of being able to reduce benefits again for that group in the middle to a certain level without going back to them for approval. And I think you'll see by the time I'm done, we will have used up all of that flexibility by March. The second thing is actually, an update I gave in November 12th. Some of you may have been there. To then the Joint Committee on Health and Human Resources. That's when I was interim administrator of OMAP, so I've been in a few acting capacities here. But to let you know where we are and what's coming up, the FEOP expansion began November 1st. FEOP began claiming federal match on its program and has been engaging in the activities to kind of start marketing to begin that expansion. We continue to have on schedule the expansion for pregnant women and children from 170 to 185% of the poverty level February 1st. It's important that we do that expansion because as part of this, we are using up all of our available CHIP dollars, the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is at a higher match rate. It's a 70-30 match rate. So it's important that we show an expansion for people, for children who would normally be eligible for CHIP. So we will continue to do that. I think even in a ramped-up program, it's probably about 1,700 or so that we would expect to be in that. So it's not a huge expansion in terms of number of people. We plan on implementing the standard benefit package, and I'll get to that in a moment, February 1st. Now, the expansion that was to go beyond that and what the legislature, the emergency board, had done when they approved our submittal of the waiver was to say they wanted most of the expansion to occur in the FEOP program, and that for those who didn't have employer-sponsored coverage, that initially we would go to 110% of the federal poverty level, that the language both in the statute and the waiver would allow us to go to 185, but it's subject to funds available. So the original direction from the e-board was that we go to 110 as we started the program. But the November emergency board, because of the budget problems, has delayed that expansion. So that expansion will not be occurring until, well, maybe July 1st. Now, the benefits, the benefit package is an important piece, and what's interesting is this is the piece that stirred the most controversy and the most discussion in Oregon. And when we got to the federal government, they had hardly any questions about it. It was very interesting how much time we spent on it. But if you turn to the back, let me explain both what we will begin the program with, what will be eliminated as of March 1st because of November rebalance, and then what also is on the list if Measure 28 does not pass. We are required to provide Medicaid-mandated services to this population. So the federal government said, we will allow you the flexibility to go down to Medicaid-mandated services. And that, if you wanted to draw a line, it would basically be the top 6 categories. So inpatient, hospital, outpatient, emergency room, physician, lab, and x-ray and ambulance services are mandated services. The benefits that we would begin with is everything on this page. Now, what does that not include? It does not include vision. It's a significant reduction in dental care. There's no non-emergency medical transportation. Normally, you're required to provide medical transportation to Medicaid services. It also would require significant copays, as you can see, and these would be mandatory copays, meaning that if a person refuses to pay it, the provider can refuse services. Now, that's under Medicaid law. There are some laws that other laws that would guide hospitals that would not allow them to deny that, at least in an emergency situation. And so this the total package you see here to start out with was at about 78% of the value of the regular package. So again, we had savings there we were capturing. And the order in which you'll see these is an order prescribed by the Health Services Commission. They were asked to look at what's most important, what's next most important. Now, the detailed prioritized list of healthcare services overlays this. So if something isn't covered, if there's a condition treatment pair that's not covered for the plus population, it's also not going to be covered for the standard population. Now, what happened in the November Emergency Board was that in order to deal with some of the DHS rebalance issues, the Emergency Board moved that as of March 1, these services on the bottom be dropped. Again, these are for the 100,000 or so who are in the standard population. So as of March 1, the remainder of dental will be gone, medical supplies will be gone, and I'm sorry, the other thing that's not covered even to start with is actually medical equipment, and outpatient mental health and chemical dependency will be gone. If hospital 50, measure 28 fails, prescription drugs will be gone. That means we will have used up all of the flexibility. We will have gone down to Medicaid-mandated services for the 100,000 or so who are in standard. We also, besides that, in terms of other changes for OHP standard clients that result from these waivers, there will now be a six-month uninsurance requirement. We have changes in premium policies so that we've had premiums, but they'll be more stringent. You don't pay, you will lose your coverage within about a 60-day period, and the premiums are somewhat higher. And if someone is in standard and they do have access to employer-sponsored coverage and FEOP is open for that, they will be required to take that. They can't make a choice. It'll be cheaper to go into FEOP, cheaper for the state. As we look then at where we are after March and into next biennium, if measure, let me phrase this in terms of if measure 28 does not pass. You will have, in essence, you will have for 100,000 people just these top services here. And I think there certainly is a concern that some of those services that are considered optional in the federal government's mind, prescription drugs, mental health, and chemical dependency especially, without those services, you likely will pay more for the mandated services, and you may also see a shift to the public safety system as well. Mm-hmm. The governor's balanced budget, and the governor has very clearly stated that this is just a starting point for discussions. It extends all of the reductions that are part of this, as well as there are some provider reimbursement reductions, extends all of those into 305. On top of that, there's also a delay in the eligibility effective date, which if you want to hear more about that, when I leave, Lynn can talk about that. The governor's balanced budget also eliminates adult dental for all Oregon Health Plan clients, even those who are in plus. And this will take a statutory change. It eliminates funding for provider, not only for provider rate increases, but any utilization increases. And utilization for all populations, public and private, is increasing. So I think it's very clear from the governor's perspective that this is that is really not a sustainable program either, and it is a program where access will be severely hindered without being able to compensate managed care plans for rate or utilization increases. I think certainly we will have a loss of managed care, probably a complete loss, or easily a complete loss of managed care for all clients, not only for the standard clients. So what does this mean? This means we need to completely rethink what we're doing in the health plan. It's not a situation of starting with where we are in March and then saying, how do we cut further? It really means going back and starting from scratch. And for those of us who were part of the conception of the health plan, that's a little difficult to do. And when we've seen what the health plan has been able to accomplish for individuals and actually for the healthcare system, I think, over the last few years. But that's where we are. And so we were engaged in discussions with the transition team, and we'll be engaging, obviously, with the legislature in discussions if we were going to start from scratch right now, given our economic situation. Is there a way for us to restructure this program in such a way that we can consolidate the gains we've made and try to do it in a way that we still live within the state budget? I think, obviously, one answer to it is let's get rid of our waivers and let's leave those 100,000 who are in the standard program without coverage. But if there is a way for us to really restructure benefits on those, I mentioned prescriptions and mental health and chemical dependency, I think we're very concerned that without those services, we will see increased costs in the hospitals. We will see increased costs in our public safety system. That maybe there's a way for us to completely restructure and really try to look at a way we can, maybe with a very skinny and focused benefit package for the standard population, to be able to avoid some of the worst consequences of what I think we might otherwise be faced with. So we're up for the discussion, and I think it's something we need to engage in together with all of the stakeholders. We're at a situation, I would say, that we can't just say we're going to do this or that. There are huge consequences no matter what direction we go, not only for the health plan budget, but also for the budget for the Department of Human Services and for the budget for public safety and for Oregonians as a whole. So I can say in my new role as DHS director, I look forward to having those discussions with you and really trying to explore over the coming months how we can put a package together that does help us deal with I think some of the worst consequences we'd be concerned with.
I know Gene has to be back at 2:00. Did you want to ask a question?
Just a couple of things real quick. I know that the Congress is looking at some prescription drug benefit monies. And
I'm sorry, who is?
The Congress. Oh. And can you help us understand a little bit how that might either help or...
I'm Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, I'm not up on what this week's plan might be. I do know that one of the possibilities that's being considered is that if there is a Medicare drug benefit, there's many ways they can structure it. They could have a Medicare drug benefit but still somehow require the states for those who are dual eligible. We have a number of people who have Medicare and Medicaid coverage to have states pick it up. But I think that one way to provide some relief to states would be if there, and I don't see that this is going to happen in the next 6 months, but if there is a Medicare drug benefit, that for those who are then eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, if Medicare picks that up, that would take a substantial burden off of our budget, because our highest expenditures are for elderly and disabled and prescription drugs.
Chairman, Gene, I would just encourage you, and I would be glad to do what I can do up to it, including traveling back to Washington, D.C. Now, the information that I'm getting is that the Congress will pass some form of drug prescription benefit. The question really is how large will it be, and which audiences will it, how are they going to structure it? And I think that Oregon is situated very well right now to have that discussion with the administration, because I don't think, there are like 40-plus states that are having fiscal problems right now and severe fiscal problems. This is a way that the Congress can facilitate assisting the states in a very, very critical area. So I would encourage having those discussions.
I think I'd be hopeful that it would pass. A question might be how long before it's actually implemented, but I think it does offer some potential hope of pulling some costs off of the state.
And then the second question I have, FEOP, under this particular kind of downward slide, where's FEOP headed?
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, I think a question will be from the federal government. Well, if we never do any expansion, I think they are going to have serious questions about maintaining our waivers. Right. And it's the waivers that have allowed us to also get the federal match on FEOP. And so the structure of FEOP, the policy behind FEOP, has to be part of all of these discussions that we have around the Oregon Health Plan. But right now, they're able to claim federal match. I think the question will be if we basically have said to the federal government we're using all our flexibility to reduce benefits, but there's very little expansion in that.
What are we, what are we using to fund it now, the match?
Tobacco settlement.
So we're using tobacco settlement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Just to let you know, I'm going to be introducing a bill that will be a cents per hour employer contribution to begin that discussion to see where the employer groups go with that and what they do with it. But I think when you leverage 70% on 30%, that's a pretty substantial leverage, and provide insurance to working individuals, that makes a lot of sense to me. So.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks. Lynn will be here if you have additional questions. And then also, as I said, for those of you who are on human resources, I know I'll be there in the next few days. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. And good luck.
I don't know what you mean.
That's a little gallows humor, Gene. Lynn, would you come up? Now, we're going to have time. We're going to take time for testimony from 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 individuals, many of whom drove a long way to get here, to talk about some of their immediate medical needs. This is invited testimony. And so, Lynn, I'd like to take at least 45 minutes because we're limiting their time, get their testimony from, 3 to 5 minutes, and then there needs to be time for questions in terms of what they have to say. So I would say maybe 15 minutes of whatever you want to do.
Mr. Chair, I'm Lynn Reed, the Acting Administrator for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services. And really, it was not my intent to present any information to you. It was, as Gene has to leave, knowing that you did not have a lot of time to ask questions, to be available to answer questions. And that can include, if it plays out that you want that to be at the end of the public testimony, I'll be here through that as well and available to answer questions.
Well, I know there are probably questions that people have been waiting to ask, so do we want to do that now, or do you want to wait until after we hear the testimony?
Well,
yes, Senator.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, because I know you did some of this in response to questions I brought to you earlier last week. I would like to hear from Lynn about these letters that went out to people saying it's in their medical benefits. Perhaps she could review that process, how people got notified, and what the department is doing to assist those people. And then I'd like to hear from those people who have come today, some of whom are my constituents, and then perhaps Lynn could respond. Does that sound like a good way
to
go?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I too would like to have some of that explained, but I would question the idea of Lynn going first, because these folks are going to have some questions and Lynn could answer some of those without involving all the questions later on at the end, and I think it might smooth the process up.
So what are you suggesting?
That we go, people come and present the problems they have or the testimony that they have, and then allow Lynn to do that and go into the questions afterwards, if indeed there are questions after.
Okay. Well, as far as, I think that's good. As far as explaining what you could possibly do, now just tell very briefly about the letter. Do you have a copy of that?
I do have a copy of the letters. There have been a number of letters that have been sent out from the department related to changes in eligibility and benefits for clients. The letter I think that you may be primarily focused on right now is for those clients who are served in the medically needy program. Mm-hmm. And that program has a limited benefit package of prescription drugs, mental health, and chemical dependency services, as well as transportation to access those services. That is a program that serves generally a slightly higher income population, and they are persons with disabilities and seniors who participate in that program. About three-fourths of them have Medicare coverage, so this program is used a lot for the direct benefit, which Medicare doesn't cover currently. The department did send out computer-generated notices to those about 8,000 medically needy clients, the notice was a bad notice in that it was computer-generated. It was small type. I don't believe it even had, a letterhead identifier in terms of the department, and the department recognizes the error made there. Similar notices were sent out for clients who are receiving services under the General Assistance Program and some of the long-term care programs, which had similar faults. And the department is looking at, addressing that. Future notices will not have those same shortcomings. In terms of the types of services that might be available.
Well, we'll do that.
You don't want to do that now.
Yeah,
okay.
We'll wait until we hear. Okay, I'd like to have three individuals. I think there are three chairs. Jeremy Gunn, Sheila Lowe, and Tracia Hope. Could you each come up, and I will start in that order, Jeremy, Sheila, and Tricia. And if you would thank you very much for being here. Thank you. We appreciate it. And I know some of you have come a long way. It hasn't been easy to get here. You may not have been in this position before, testifying before a committee. Take your time. We would like to have the time limit anywhere from maybe 3 to 5 minutes, because there may be questions, and we have about an hour to do the whole thing. And I would like each of you to start with your name and address. That would be the first thing, and then go into your testimony. So, Jeremy, would you like to?
Mr. Chairman and committee and members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Gunn. My address is 1817 8th Street, Springfield, Oregon, 97477. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me, my concerns about cutting the medically needy program. This is an emergency crisis for me and thousands of fellow Oregonians who have been kept alive and well due to this medically needy program. To cut this program is a death sentence for me, since I am HIV positive and I rely on this program for my prescription coverage. The drugs have reduced my viral load to undetectable level, and that means I will have less doctor visits and hopefully no hospitalizations. It also means that my doctor and myself can view this disease as manageable, not terminal, and that I might still be alive if there is a cure found. Interrupting or stopping these drugs will cause the virus to mutate and build an immunity to my current drug regime. Switching to other possible drugs don't guarantee the same success in managing this disease. This is a big gamble with my life right now, as it is with thousands of other currently under this program. If you could trade places with anyone who received a two-week notice that as of January 31st you lose all benefits and coverage, you would feel and know how scared and helpless many people feel right now. I am sure that each one of us here knows someone who will be affected by cutting the medically needy program. Maybe a mother, father, son, daughter, grandchild, or a close friend whose life is dependent upon this program for prescriptions, nursing homes, foster care, mental health, counseling, or drug and alcohol intervention, homeless and others who benefit from this program. I was born and raised in Oregon and have supported state taxes for over a 30-year period. My parents did the same for over a 50-year period. It is important, it is this support that has helped thousands of people before me. Unfortunately, I now need my state to help take care of me and to stay a lot and help me stay alive and have the best quality of life that I can have. I would gladly trade places with anyone so I could become an active member of society by having a 9-to-5 job and pay taxes that would help support much needed programs for the less fortunate. That's what this country and Oregon is about, caring for one another. But life takes unexpected turns, and I don't have choice anymore. Having the medically needy program has given me hope that I will be around to watch my grandsons grow up. Or to be able to give my other daughter in hand in marriage. It has also given me good enough health that I am able to attend church weekly, where I find much needed spiritual loving support from my church family. No price tag can be applied to this value for me. To cut this program without regarding the consequences to human life, especially for the people that need it the most, is a devastating thought. It is our responsibility as compassionate and loving, caring human beings to help give the disabled and less fortunate the chance of having the best possible life possible, and for me, just life itself. We all need and have a right to feel that our lives are important enough to find a way to keep the medically needy program. I am pleading with you to find a solution to this emergency crisis affecting so many. Thank you again for taking the time to listen to me.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
I would ask that we not even neither applaud or jeer or to make any response. This goes back to my mayor days, where we used to have to, we had raucous meetings where people did such things until we had them escorted out of the room. But I appreciate your support and your emotional involvement. I appreciate that. Sheila, would you like to present?
My name is Sheila Lowe, and I live at 1090 Willa Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97404. I want to thank all of you who have come here today to listen to testimony, and I especially want to thank Senator Morissette for inviting me here today. After hearing the stories of folks in Oregon who will die without the medicine that the medically needy program provides, I'm hesitant to sit up here and tell my story. As a result of the program being shut down, I won't lose my life. I will, however, lose the quality of life I've worked very hard to have. 4 years ago, I was stricken with severe lower body muscular joint and nerve pain. I could go on and on about all the specialists, the tests, and the interventions to heal me, but in the end, treating the symptoms and therapeutic exercise as I could tolerate it were all that could be done. My pain had become chronic. I lost my job, my lifestyle, couldn't drive a car, and could barely sleep at all. 2 hours a night was good. I was put on a pain management program that included long-acting opiate medications and other meds, which combined with the other aspects of the program began to allow me to slowly get my life back somewhat. It wasn't easy, and even with the meds, I would have given anything for a moment's real relief. I was improving a little but not able to return to work, and once on disability, I was put on Medicare. I lost the good insurance I had for my job, and I had no more prescription coverage. Mercifully, I qualified for the medically needy program, and for several months have been able to get my prescriptions at no cost. I've never been so grateful for something in my life, as my monthly medication bill is four times the amount of my monthly income. Then, with no warning, a letter came telling me my prescriptions are being cut off in 20 days. Not only do I have face a life of pain and inactivity again, but how am I going to cope with the getting off the drugs that I'll almost certainly have to do within 20 days? 20 days is not enough warning. Why weren't we told sooner? I'm not a legislator nor an accountant, but I'm aware of the huge chunk of money that is allocated to Oregon's medically needy program each year. Perhaps the concept of triage, where the sickest and neediest people get the first available help, would be worth considering in Oregon. And I don't even necessarily include myself among those people. But if we have any compassion at all, shouldn't we help the suffering and the critically ill by providing prescription coverage? How can we tell innocent people that we can't provide life-saving medicine anymore? How is it possible that life and death concerns are anywhere but at the top of Oregon's priority list? Let's please rethink this. We need to fight to save lives because it's the right thing to do. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you, Sheila. Okay, Tracia, would you like to continue? Teresa.
Yeah, I'm Teresa Hope. I live at 34335 Highway 58, Eugene, Oregon, 97405. I'm disabled. I have brain damage. I don't have notes, so I've been on the program since in the 90s, and I had to go through a lot to get on this program. And I'm talking about people like me because I'm still on the program. I'm not off. But if I didn't have my medication or any of my medical help, I don't want to be like the person I was because I was suicidal. I take about 18 pills a day. This is hard for me because I'm nervous.
You're doing good.
I have different kinds of mood swings, and sometimes I have to go in the emergency to take a shot to calm me down, and it's very hard for me to live in this world right now because some people, they treat you differently because you're disabled. I don't mind being disabled because I had it all my life because I was abused mentally and physically and hit in the head. So this medicine that we have to take is very, it controls us. It helps us to focus on things. There's a lot I still don't know. There's a lot I still have to learn. But I'm trying, and I'm trying to get there. So I'm hoping that people like me can stay on the program and get what we need.
Would you tell us about the difficulty you had getting here today?
I had to borrow $20 from my mother to get here. I live on a small income, so it was very hard because I was broke. And I had to borrow my mother's truck, her pickup, and then I got lost because I was by myself. And I mean lost. I had to leave here at, I left this morning about 9:30, got here almost about 11, 12. So you can imagine how long it took me just to get here. I don't even know my way out.
Now, let me ask a question of all of you. How much money per month do you spend on your pharmaceuticals, approximately?
The cost of my drugs is way over $2,000 a month to sustain my life each day. That includes mental health drugs as well as my HIV drugs. And without my mental health drugs, then I'll end up in, you know, somewhere, but I'll have my HIV drugs. But, you know, I'm just...
Okay, good. Thank you.
All my drugs combined are over $3,000 a month.
I'm not sure. Sometimes I can't read the...
But a lot.
Yeah. A lot. A lot.
Are there other questions?
Are there other services that are provided other than pharmaceutical?
I do. I have medical transportation to get to my appointments. I have dental. I don't know if I'm going to have dental anymore, but I did have, and then I get my glasses every 2 years, and I don't know if I'm going to have that anymore. let's see. I get... I have the emergency, you know, for the ambulance, because I have mixed mood swings, and then I have seizures, mixed seizures that I don't even know if they're coming or going. When you have brain damage, you don't have too much control of what happens to you.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. And we'll go ahead and take your seats, and we will ask Lloyd Taylor, Diane Miller, and Wendy Knox. Well, let's do two and two. So Lloyd Taylor and Diane Miller, would you please come up? And then we'll do Wendy Knox and Amber Drummond together. And I hope that you all stay until the end of the session, because we will have an opportunity to hear from the, not only the senators, but a response. Okay, are we missing somebody?
Lloyd Taylor.
Lloyd Taylor, is he in the room? Okay, Wendy, not Wendy.
I'm Diane Miller.
Okay, Diane. How about Amber? Is she here? Okay, Amber, why don't you come up? Oh, okay. Both of you. That'll work. Is Lloyd here? Okay, Diane Miller, would you like to start, please? Give us your name and address first.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Diane Miller. I reside at 93142 Park Street, Cheshire. My zip code is 97419. I would like to speak to you from the heart. And I'm sorry if I get emotional, but hearing these other people's testimonies also let me know that sometimes life's gray cloud hangs over a lot of heads. I'm speaking to you on the behalf of my husband, who is seated back there.
He lost his kidney function 6 years ago. We've seen him through death straits many times while on hemodialysis. Hemodialysis is not a pretty picture, and you don't ever want to lose your kidney function. It's not a fun thing. And he waited patiently for a kidney transplant. And there came a phone call on October the 23rd of the year of 2002 at 11:30. As he picked up the phone, it was them. And he said, "I get to pack my bag. I get to pack my bag. It's finally here." His birthday was the 24th. By the time I got him up to Legacy, he said, "Did you know you've given me a birthday present?" But as we received the mail, just 2 weeks ago, there was a letter that has pulled all of his hopes away, saying he will no longer have prescription coverage. Without these prescriptions, my husband will die. He's no longer able to go back on dialysis. All of his accesses are used up. They're not accessible. And they found that out as they were trying to transplant him, putting in his catheters. So he went up black and blue from the neck clear down to his knees as he were desperately trying to find an access to hook him up. If there's anything I could say, if I could beg and plead, yes, please, have mercy upon these people. My husband has worked hard all his life in the home building. And one day he came home and said, "Get me to the doctor or call the undertaker," as he collapsed on the floor. That's when we found it out. It was the day after Christmas. Our lights went out. Our party was over. Our future was gone. I've got four children, and out of those four children, two have the same disease. So this is a very hard thing for us, because I know what they're up against. If we just had the Medicaid coverage for kidney transplant people, Social Security now picks up their immunity suppressant meds. All we need is $300 from Medicaid to give him life. $1,700 is what his immunity suppressants cost. That's what we need help for. That's what we don't have. And that's all that I can say is, please, help. Put the smile back on his face. It was so wonderful to see him walk again, smile, and be happy. But that's been drawn from him again. Thank you.
Wendy Knotts.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Wendy Knotts. I live at 1959 Brewer in Eugene, Oregon, 97401. And I've come from Eugene to tell you about the impact that the budget cuts have had on myself and my children. I have a disabled son, age 20. He has shunted hydrocephalus and cerebral palsy. He had two brain bleeds in 1999 when he had surgery for shunt failure. His shunt can only be replaced in Portland at OHSU. He takes 11 meds. They are for head pain, depression, sleep problems, allergies, and asthma. I also have twins who are 17 years old. They're juniors in high school. One of the twins, my son, has ADHD, which is medicated for. He also has allergies and asthma. The other twin, my daughter, has chronic ear infections, allergies, and asthma. I am on disability myself and am divorced and a single parent. I have a total of four children. One is out of the house. Unfortunately, I got all the bad genes in my family. I'm a steroid-dependent asthmatic, diabetic, have a stent in my heart, have high blood pressure, early-onset osteoporosis, have had part of the meniscus removed from both knees, also a thyroid problem, depression, reflux, fibromyalgia, allergies, irregular heartbeat, migraines, have trouble sleeping, high cholesterol, high triglycerides, restless leg syndrome, and Cushing syndrome. got one causes me to look the way I do. I take 41 different meds, inhalers, nasal sprays, and injections every day. I have been on these medications for a long time and do not foresee going off them anytime soon. My copay on my and my son's meds are $2 to $3 each, which seems nominal until you figure out how many meds we're on. I have several meds I must buy over the counter to keep my bones strong, calcium, aspirin to keep my blood thin so as not to aggravate my heart problem. These I pay full price for. I have private insurance that the state pays a premium for now, but I paid for it for a while so I wouldn't lose it. This so I wouldn't be a total burden on the state, which I don't want to have happen. The state only pays the pharmacy $10 per prescription. My private insurance pays the rest. The same with the doctor visits, except the state pays $15, which is the copay for the visit. Now I am forced to pay $3 every time I go to see a doctor, or $2 to $3 to get a prescription. It doesn't seem like much until you add it all up. I don't have an exact amount yet as to what our pharmaceuticals will cost, but my estimates are around $150. The only place in my budget that I could even begin to get that amount of money is in our food budget, so we're having to go get food boxes to come anywhere close to making ends meet. Living on food boxes is extremely hard when you are diabetic. They don't have the sugar-free or low-sugar things that I need. Please understand that I have my dignity, but we are sinking fast. $150 plus a month is a lot of money plus. And from what I see at the church where they hand these food boxes out, there are a lot of other people in the same boat. Thank you for your time. I know you will do the right thing and not let those of us dependent on your decisions fall through the cracks. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Amber Drummond. I live at 1230 D Court, also in Eugene. Zip code is 97402. I feel really fortunate that I'm not in the position. Excuse me. That the rest of the people are in. However, I do feel that there are many of us who feel that our positions are as important. I just found out last week, actually, that I would be losing the dental benefits and mental health benefits for my organ health plan. I had some work started on my teeth, which I had to have postponed due to a condition called TMJ in my jaw. I am unable to open my jaw far enough to complete the work, and Oregon Health Plan does not pay for any TMJ treatment, so I was forced to wait until I could acquire the funds on my own, which are about 50% of my monthly income, to complete only one of the three needed procedures. Due to this, I have work on a couple of my teeth that will not be finished. If it is not finished, I will lose those teeth. That looks like a very small price, considering there are people that are faced with losing their lives due to the cuts that are being made. I feel that medical coverage, dental coverage, and mental health coverage equally need to be considered as a total combination for people's physical well-being. I think that there's a lot of cuts that are being made that are absolutely unheard of. People will be dying because of the cuts that are being made. This is not one person that has one problem. This is an entire state with thousands of people that are going to be horribly affected. I have a child that's going to be 3 years old that in the past has recurringly had to use a I can't even think of the name of the machine for breathing, a nebulizer, thank you very much. And in the amount of money that they have paid, the state, the Oregon Health Fund has paid to rent the machine the three or four times that she's needed it, they could have purchased the machine. They chose not to do that. There are other ways that cuts could be made to be more sufficient for the Oregon Health Plan, mm-hmm. rather than cutting programs in general. They show on this one here that if they do this middle column, if they cut out some of the stuff, that they can add this many more people. My question is,
what is the point if everybody's going to have inadequate care instead of good care for the few that actually have been receiving it? I just hope that something that is heard today will affect the decisions that are being made on the Oregon Health Plan.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, now the hot seat. Any thoughts that you have?
Mr. Chair, you know, as Senator Shields had indicated, you know, one of the principles that he would like to see guide the decisions made is one of compassion, mm-hmm. and you know, I do acknowledge that. Compassion, you know, although I feel compassion, we've been forced to put on the table cuts that will impact, obviously, people's lives and sometimes the very, you know, being able to continue to live. The department has been faced with a number of cuts to be put in place to deal with revenue shortfalls for the balance of the biennium. And they have forced us into looking at this is one of our options. This particular program, the Medically Needy Program, although I heard more than the Medically Needy Program addressed here, is a reduction that will take place only if ballot measure 28 fails. And I don't think that's been mentioned before. Even if ballot measure 28 passes, that is not necessarily the long-term solution. I recognize that. I know that Senator Walker, you know, has taken the lead in terms of setting up in the Springfield and in Eugene areas a drug fair that is bringing together some of the pharmaceutical manufacturers and individuals that might qualify for their compassionate care access to drug services. I mean, it's those types of services that are what's left unless we can come up with, depending upon what happens with ballot measure 28, unless we can come up with revenue to fund the program. This particular medically needy program has a $7 million general fund reduction for the balance of the biennium. Beyond that, there are some additional programs out there that some people might qualify for. There's the Oregon High Risk Pool, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, may be available to some individuals. However, persons with Medicare would not qualify for that. There's the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP. Once again, persons with Medicare would not qualify for that. We're about to implement a senior prescription drug assistance program, although you have to have a period of 6 months on insurance before you could qualify for that program, and that is for persons age 65 and above. That was a bill of Senator Menezes that's about to be implemented. I'd be glad to respond to
Senator Walker and then Senator Menezes. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lynn, I appreciate you being here, and I don't mean any disrespect or want to target you at all with some of the questions that I have, but you know, clearly we have pretty serious situations here. Diane Miller's husband will die if he doesn't get prescription drugs. This doesn't seem to be very compassionate at all. Is there any way to prioritize some of these folks who clearly, I mean, this gentleman will die without his drugs. And I
you know, it, there doesn't seem to be any way that you've tried to prioritize these 8,000. You told me there were eight. You told this committee there were 8,000 letters that went out, and I'm glad you're going to retool those in the future because they're pretty harsh. We've had hundreds of phone calls into my office from folks. And these folks don't have access to a computer. Some of them don't even have a telephone. They have so little money. So they can't access these prescription drug programs. And that's why we're putting together these forums to help people get information about that. But you only gave them 20 days notice. So I guess I've got several questions in there. Why was the notice period so short? What are you doing to help these people? And was there any effort to prioritize those people within that medically needy program rather than just cutting everyone off? I mean, and it's hard for me to say that one person is less medically needy than another, but clearly we have some people who are not going to make it tomorrow if their drugs are cut off.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I cannot answer, although I'll get back to you in terms of the 20 days notice. The notice was issued by the part of the department that does eligibility, not the part that I work within, which is the benefits side. But that'll be something that I will get back to you in terms of the timing on that notice. In terms of prioritizing who might receive coverage under the medically needy program, generally speaking, in order to draw down Medicaid funds, you cannot. They look at it from the opposite perspective. You cannot discriminate on the basis of diagnosis. And so one of the things we would have to explore would be whether or not the federal government would consider waivers that would allow us to target coverage under the Medicaid program, the medically needy program, to specific conditions. But that wouldn't be timely for the slated end of this program. There is a small amount of money that was set aside that was intended for some dollars to go to the community mental health system for antipsychotic medications. And there is a group working to try and see how there wouldn't be any Medicaid match involved. It would just be pure state funds. There's a group working to see how they could distribute those dollars, looking at perhaps some type of a voucher system. And then we would also explore whether or not our mail order vendor might consider allowing folks who have those vouchers to purchase at a reduced rate. But beyond that, there was nothing that we felt we could do and implement timely to get the necessary reduction in dollar value.
So you missed one part of my question, though, and that was, what are you doing to help these people? You sent out a letter. You told them they couldn't appeal the decision. They could appeal other aspects, but they couldn't appeal the decision that the program would be cut. But how are you assisting them in obtaining their medications and obtaining other services through other programs? I mean, there's 8,000. I don't know how your staff can deal with 8,000 people.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, once again, I am, you know, it's too bad we don't have the eligibility agency here with me because that's where that assistance would take place. And I am not knowledgeable about the efforts that are going on there, but we will get back to you with what information they are providing, which is the contact point for a client, is with their caseworker in terms of what assistance is being provided. But there are very few programs for which the individuals in this program, the medically needy program, might qualify because of the because their income may be too high, or they don't meet the right category in terms of medical coverage under Medicaid.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Lynn, I just wanted to thank you for coming. You do, your agency takes a lot of heat. And I guess I wanted to say to my colleagues here, the discussion that we're really having, and I voted for Measure 28 and sent it out of the legislature for the people to decide, When this discussion, to a large degree, is manufactured, and I'll tell you why, we shouldn't even be talking about cutting these programs. It reminds me of 1993, and to me it's a ridiculous discussion. When it is true that we spend $2,000 per child more for public education in Oregon than the state of Washington does or the state of California does, when that is true, and it's a fact, and then we engage in these discussions, it's largely disingenuous to the individuals who are recipients of these programs, because clearly when you have individuals whose lives, their very lives, depend on receiving appropriate prescription medications, to have this discussion in light of and knowing that we spend $2,000 per child more in our public education system than Washington and California. And yesterday we had a large-scale rally on the front steps with all of the people tirading about more money, more money, we want more money for education. The reality is that those individuals tend to win the political discussion here. And that's the sad debate, because to the degree that they're successful, they encroach on programs like this that are largely meeting the needs of a population that are incapable of helping themselves. And that's the tragedy that I see in all of this. And we can, as a legislature, discuss the idea of raising more money through more taxes, but we have to answer to the people of the state of Oregon for that purpose. And in 1993, co-chairing Ways and Means, when faced with the same problems downstairs, my decision, and the Speaker of the House then, was to cut $400 million from K-12 and shift the money to human services. And I rode the heat for that in the public. And quite honestly, I'll tell the public and the governor and whomever else, I'm willing to do it again. Because this is a stupid discussion that we're having about cutting these programs. And it unfortunately, I think, is malicious. And it is hurtful on the people who receive the benefits in these programs.
Okay, thank you. Other comments? Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I have a real hard time sitting here listening to these stories that we've heard and things, knowing how real they are, and knowing a little bit about the background of some of this, things that lead us to the position we're in right now. It's absolutely infuriating. I was quoted in the Oregonian nearly two years ago that it was criminal what was going on. I maintain that today. I have very little respect for people that go along with a governor that's willing to bargain the health of the elderly and the disabled against school kids so that he can stroke his ego that he's gotten more taxes out of the people, more government for money for government to spend. It's absolutely insufferable to do something like this. Put these people through this. It's the last thing in the world they need. I have a real problem losing respect, or finding any respect for people that will go along with someone like that to protect their job. And at the same time as they're cutting this out, they're hiring and having more people in their agencies when they're supposed to be reorganizing and slimming down, and going ahead and doing that full bore when these folks are being cut back. And I can't put it any plainer than that. I've talked until I'm horse in the face, talked with everybody that's had anything to do with these budgets. It's like talking to a wall. And who gets the complaints and who gets the rub coming back? We do. And it's not what we've done. The direction and the general direction the legislature has taken is for these monies to be, these programs to be protected. They haven't been. They've been thrown right back at us after all this work that we've done in five special sessions. And frankly, I hope to see a change in it. And I hope to goodness the new governor has got some grace and some ability to instantaneously put some of these things right and to take some money from some of the other places that have been just going ahead and spending and increasing the government bureaucracy and put it out there to take care of these people that have been here today and others like them. If we don't do that, then so help me, we don't have any compassion, we don't have any reason to be.
Thank you. Okay. Other comments? Senator Minnis?
During the fifth special session, Lynn, we discussed the Secretary of State's audit of the Oregon Health Plan, and if I recall correctly, there were roughly 15,000 people is a number that the Secretary of State extrapolated out as being persons in the program who are not eligible under federal law. And if I recall my math correctly, it's roughly $300 per year. Is that correct? Or 300? What's the cost per member on average on the Oregon Health Plan? Is it 330?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, it would probably be close to the $300 per person per month.
So we've got 15,000 people in the Oregon Health Plan who are not qualified under federal law or are not residents of the state or otherwise are cheating the system, and it's $330 per month per person. Is my math wrong in saying that's somewhere close to $100 million?
I don't have a calculator. I can't do it that well in my head, sir.
I came up with $45 million, assuming 15,000 people and 300. That was a month. So I guess I have to get my calculator out. That's a heck of a lot of money. So one of the things I might suggest we do is take a good hard look at the residency issue. I know we've been back and forth on this thing, and we think that we can't be hard-nosed with people about their residences, but, you know, I think we ought to. I think we ought to look at challenging people on where they live. I hear from Oregon State police troopers and Portland police officers who stop individuals who are clearly identifying themselves as residents of the state of Washington, the state of California, et cetera, coming into the state. And why are they coming here? Because they're going to visit their doctor, because they're on the Oregon Health Plan. It's rooting out some of those things and finding some efficiencies and economies in the system that we also need to work on that. So on the other hand, as I said earlier, I would cut some of the other categories and put the money here. I think there are some efficiencies and economies that we should be looking at internally here too, and not just forget that those problems exist. So, and I know you guys are trying hard. You got new leadership over there. So any comments with respect to that, and where you all think you're going?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, we definitely agree with you that we should continue to focus in terms of identifying those efficiencies and economies and those things that could be done would be allowed under federal regulations. There are some constraints, obviously, there, but that I would expect during this legislative session that you and I know Senator Westland's committee are looking at taking a relook at the Oregon Health Plan, for example, or the Medicaid program, and if you were to build that program from scratch, what it might look like, and how might you go about building in some of these economies or efficiencies into that program. And we certainly hope to be partners with you or engaged in that effort and certainly do support looking at those issues.
Okay. I do have a question that came to mind. I wrote down earlier about eligibility. Now, there is a six-month eligibility waiting period, time period. To explain that.
Mr. Chair, beginning February 1, for those individuals who are applying for the Oregon Health Plan who would only qualify because of the waivers that we have, that's about a fourth of our clients, current clients. They're generally persons age 19 through 64 who don't fit in one of the other categories, and they would have a six-month uninsurance requirement.
Okay. Now, speaking of eligibility requirements, residency requirements, I know that it's against federal regulations to base assistance because of Medicare, Medicaid on eligibility strictly. However, there is anecdotal information about people coming to Oregon to deliver babies and going back to where they're coming from and so on. But to sign up in terms of a six-month eligibility, you would have to seemingly establish some residency during that time period. I mean, unless you came to the state, signed up, went back to another state, and came back in 6 months. I mean, that's...
Mr. Chair, certainly there are some federal barriers in terms of establishing, for example, a length of time residency. It's merely an intent to reside, and that is a concern, though. But I think the issue that Senator Menas brought up was maybe some verification of residency, which would also get to that issue.
Well, like either driver's license or voter's registration or something that would take them a little time and effort to get to establish, to show residency. Keeping in mind that children born of aliens are citizens of the United States and they are entitled to services, and so I'm sure there's a kind of a cloudy line between illegal aliens who there is a verification, at least on the application form, that they check. Do we check that? Do we verify?
Mr. Chair, obviously, as you said, the children are U.S. citizens, and they would be covered. In terms of the parents, if a person is a non-citizen and could be here legally or not, we do have to provide under the Medicaid rules emergency assistance, which includes delivery, although not prenatal care. And so we do that regardless, if the person meets the rest of the criteria.
Other questions, comments?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure you understand. It's not just people who happen to be illegal aliens, say, from another country. We're talking about people who live in Washington
California. I was talking about that anecdotal piece of information about that.
Okay.
Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking again at the letter, Ms. Reed, that your the eligibility department sent out, and it doesn't say in this letter that I have a copy of that their benefits would, if Measure 28 passes, their benefits would not cease. But that's my understanding from your testimony today, is if ballot Measure 28 passes, then the 8,000 people that you sent notice to will be reinstated in the program. Is that what I understood?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that is correct for the medically needy program, although some of the individuals spoke of other programs, for example, the reduced benefit for OHP standard, and that isn't impacted except for drug coverage by the ballot measure.
Okay, so I can be safe to say if they're in the medically needy program, they're calling my office, you're going to be okay if ballot Measure 28 passes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's the exact issue, is that program would not end on February 1, and its longer-term viability, of course, rests with the legislature and budget decisions that are made.
You also, if I might, Mr. Chair, you also said that you sent out the similar letters to general assistance program participants. Are they in the same position? If Measure 28 passes, they'll be reinstated?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, no, they're not in the same position on two counts. One is the elimination of the general assistance cash program is not tied to ballot Measure 28.
Okay.
It is an action that was identified to deal with the December revenue forecast shortfall. However, those individuals who are in that program have been presumptively determined to be disabled, and so they will qualify for a different eligibility category and will continue to have regular Medicaid benefits. People like them in the future, though, who aren't already identified as general assistance clients, will need to go through a disability determination, and that procedure for working out how people will indicate they have a disability and get into that process is being worked out.
Okay. And the final question I have is, I can only pass this information on to the people who contact my office in terms of the medically needy program. We can reassure them, and if Measure 28 passes, you'll be fine. If it doesn't, I don't know what we're going to do. We're assisting people as well as we can in trying to find prescription drug programs available to meet their needs. But how are you getting that notice out to those 8,000 people? Because your letter didn't make that clear. Will you send out another notice after January 28th? And my concern is that I've already had
former State Representative Terry Thompson, who's now a county commissioner in Lincoln County, was in my office with his mental health person the other day. And they said that five people have committed suicide already because they're losing services and they're scared of what will happen to them. I want to stop that. I want to assure people that if we do pass Measure 28, they're going to be okay for the short term. So how are you getting that information out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I'll have to get back to you on that as well.
Okay. We don't have too many days to go till Measure.
I understand.
Actually, it's ballot measure. It's not ballot Measure 28, but is it? Yeah, it is,
yes.
Ballot Measure 28
on the 28th.
I'm getting confused, but yeah. Okay, well, I need to know that these people can breathe easier, at least for a few more days, till we know how that ballot measure turns out.
Thank you. Senator Shields.
Lynn, just very quickly, were all of the five or six people that spoke under the medically needy program with regard to prescription drugs that we heard from today or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I don't believe so, because as I listened to some of the testimony, it seemed like there were some benefits that a couple of individuals were receiving that are beyond the benefits provided under the medically needy program, which makes me think that a couple of individuals may be in a different program.
So what that says then is that there are some people that we listened to today who will lose prescription benefits very soon with some very serious consequences, either for the quality of life or the possibility of continuing life itself. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not one that wants to add heat, just light to the issue, and I appreciate, for instance, Senator Minnis's rational approach to bringing questions and other members as well. But it is a serious situation. I heard the statistic from former Representative Thompson, County Commissioner, now, and you know, he's waiting until he's able to establish his facts. But the fact is that even the way notices get delivered, if they are delivered to somebody with a mental illness, can cause them to possibly end their own life. So Terry was looking to confirm the reports that they'd heard from around the state. I'm looking to try and ascertain what's really going to happen and how we're going to deal with it from as compassionate a position as possible. I think Senator Minnis is on to something when he says, hey, if we can cut some of the ineligible people from getting services, there might be more money for people who clearly have eligibility for those services. I haven't said anything all afternoon because it's almost too mind-boggling to take all this stuff in, and I don't know what to say except that somehow we've got to get through this without people dying. You know, I heard a representative, and it galled me at the time, saying nobody's dying in the streets. And yet at the same time, I remember not too long back when I attended a service for people who had died in the streets of Portland for various reasons. People are going to die, and we've got to take that seriously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll add to your purpose for the committee, you said compassion, and I'll add do no harm. I hope that this committee will do no harm and will find only positive ways to help people. And with that, we're adjourned.
Thank you.